Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, October 12th. Today, as you know, is a national holiday, so schools and many workplaces are closed, having nothing to do with COVID for a change. But here's the question. What holiday is it? For the company that runs my apartment building, the offices are closed for what they call Indigenous Peoples Day. Same with many people having the day off at WNYC. But at 12:30, coming to a computer near you, New York City will hold its virtual Columbus Day Parade with its Italian-American governor, Andrew Cuomo, as the Grand Marshal, and special honoree, Dr. Anthony Fauci. So for now, at least, it's both. If you don't yet know Indigenous Peoples Day, it's a holiday that recognizes the ongoing impact of colonialism and celebrates the many different cultures of Indigenous peoples who were here before Columbus arrived and started a process that became a genocide. By now, you're probably familiar with the debate. Little history. Columbus Day has been a federal holiday since the turn of the 20th century, but a growing chorus of voices asked that their local government change Columbus Day to honor those who were living in America before 1492. The idea was first proposed during a 1977 UN conference, and in 1989, South Dakota, with its large Native American population, became the first state to ditch Columbus Day for Indigenous Peoples Day. Now more than 100 cities, towns, and counties commemorate Indigenous Peoples Day officially, and 14 states have also made the switch. New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, the states in our immediate listening area, still have Columbus Day on their official state calendars, with the exception of a few counties. And that's because for the many Italian Americans in the region, Columbus Day is an important celebration, not just of Christopher Columbus, but of Italian American history, cultural pride, and a symbol of overcoming adversity and discrimination against them. When Columbus Day was created, Italian immigrants were facing racism, and the hope was that by honoring Columbus, an Italian, as an American hero, that would be a way for Italian immigrants to be more accepted into the mainstream. Many have said, calling into the show, that getting rid of Columbus Day would be like erasing that history. But others say, can't we love and celebrate Italian-American culture without building around that guy? Maybe we should make this Indigenous Peoples Day and make a separate national holiday out of Anthony Fauci's birthday, to take one random example. So whose history should we celebrate and whose history gets erased on the second Monday in October? This year, the day happens to come at the end of a summer filled with these kinds of questions about our national identity. As you know, who gets to be honored by a memorial, a holiday, or in many cases, a statue? How do public symbols of veneration shape our national story? And for that matter, equal rights and equal justice today. Here with me now is someone who is working to address those questions. The Mellon Foundation, the largest humanities philanthropy in the United States, has pledged to spend $250 million over 5 years to help reimagine the country's approach to monuments and memorials in an effort to better reflect the nation's diversity and highlight buried or marginalized stories. Elizabeth Alexander is the president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. She's also a poet, educator, memoirist, and scholar. And she joins us now. Elizabeth, such an honor to have you again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. It is wonderful to be back so soon. Thank you.
And which holiday are you and the Mellon Foundation honoring today?
Let's guess. Here's the thing. Indigenous Peoples Day is the answer. I wonder if that will stay the name of this day forever, but I think that the reason that we don't use Columbus Day is that as you learn this history, you know, when I was growing up, I was taught only that Columbus discovered America. That was, I think, the language that most of us had. And so that's immediately interrupted once you take in the fact that there were people on the land that he discovered. There were people who were all but exterminated on the land that he discovered. The more we know of history, we have to listen to what it reveals. And that means that we assess not only our hierarchies, but also our sense that you can understand more than one story at the same time. And you have to do something with that knowledge. You can't pretend that you don't know that anymore when you're going about the business of veneration.
Some states and counties have decided, as I mentioned, as you know, to celebrate both Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day today. Is that, in your opinion, before we get to your Statues and Memorials project, a mindful solution, or do you think one needs to replace the other, or that maybe Indigenous Peoples Day should simply be moved to a separate day and separate these conversations?
Well, the thing that I don't love about Indigenous Peoples Day, frankly, is that it is far too broad. I mean, you know, that's the next issue is once we start to recognize more complex histories, which Indigenous people are we talking about? Which aspect of their history? Columbus was one person. We're talking about millions of Indigenous people. So I think that there's a lot of refining work that has to happen. And I think that also in New Haven, Connecticut, for example, a place I know well, I've been really interested to see that there are people there. As you know, it's got an Italian-American community that's been there for a long time. They are having a controversy around a Christopher Columbus statue that has stood in Worcester Square in the heart of the Italian-American community. And the question they're asking is, who amongst Italian Americans do we want to represent the greatness of our history? I myself am very interested in the Watts Towers in Los Angeles, Simon Rodio Watt, an Italian immigrant to this country who, over the course of decades, built this astonishing, beautiful, you know, vernacular tower to the sky in the middle of that community to say, thank you to America for welcoming us. So I think that once you sort of start to really go more deeply into the riches of the stories and the figures in history within an ethnicity, within a group of people, that's the hard work, but the interesting and exciting work that helps us commemorate better.
Yeah, I'm thinking a little bit when we talk about possibly having multiple holidays of the fight over MLK Day in Virginia. In the 1980s, the state celebrated Lee Jackson King Day, a combination of Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and Martin Luther King Jr. That was truly weird. And then in 2000, the state legislature made them two distinct holidays on two separate days. So there's that strange history model.
Well, yes, or, you know, I just learned a couple days ago in the state of Alabama, they celebrate King Robert E. Lee Day. I mean, this makes no sense.
No sense.
But what it tells you is that a lot of people don't want to give up, and I'll put this in quotation marks, their holidays, their statues, their heroes. And what I'm suggesting is that we all learn our history wider, deeper, better, you know, in its complicatedness mm-hmm. and in its possibility. And that what we understand is that, you know, if I'm Italian American and I want my statue, that has to be of a figure who can speak and be inspiring to anyone who may come across that person.
Yes.
And within every single ethnicity, there are those people.
And of course, it's a separate conversation that we won't have now, that in Virginia and Alabama, to use the two examples that we just used, that they continue to celebrate their Confederate traitorous leaders at all. But that's a different show.
Well, no, I mean, I think that when you look at the, and this is part of, you know, with our Monuments Project, we're starting with a nationwide audit that will be conducted by an amazing group out of Philadelphia called the Monuments Lab that will do the kind of research that we need, the aggregation of research and new research to tell us very definitively who is represented where and to what extent, so that we can think about in very, very sharp terms the tremendous disproportion of Confederate heroes who are, you know, army bases, schools, markers, statues, etc., and understand more clearly that those markers and statues were largely put up long after the Civil War was lost, and put up to instantiate an ideology of white supremacy. So I think that what that brings us to very sharply is, how do we feel about history that teaches that some people are superior and other people are subhuman, and continues to perpetuate that quite formed ideology?
Okay, Elizabeth, so what is the Monuments Project and what will you do?
Yes, so the Monuments Project, which we are really excited about, has three different aspects to it. One of them is the funding of new monuments or memorials. And there I want to say that we have a very broad definition of what a monument is. So we're not just thinking about statues of individual people in stone or bronze. There are all kinds of amazing ways that figures, ideas, movements can be commemorated in our built environment. So making new things is one big bucket. Then the contextualization of existing monuments or memorials. So some things that might be problematic as we go more deeply into our history, there are ways of teaching them that give you the layers of what these folks are all about, that gives you a counterpoint. So for example, the statue of, and this was a Monuments Lab project, of Frank Rizzo, the former late mayor of Philadelphia, who was among many things known for his very, very racist police brutality. And that statue stood in front of City Hall. People, citizens, recently took it down. But the Monuments Lab commissioned the artist Hank Willis Thomas to make a sculpture in response to that. And so he built a Black Power Afro fist pick that was large and loomed over the Frank Rizzo, you know, shadowing the Frank Rizzo, opening up a conversation about Black power and Black suppression. It was up for a length of time, some months. It's now been acquired by a museum in Philadelphia. But you can see with that example how it instantly changes the conversation around that statue, and also means that your average person passing by, because after all, what's really important about monuments is that we live amongst them. We come upon them. We sometimes go to visit them, but more often they are an ambient part of how we live. Another recontextualization that I think is really exciting is Dustin Klein in Richmond is doing a projection art project onto the statue of Robert E. Lee on Monuments Avenue, where he is projecting the face of John Lewis, the face of George Floyd, the face of Sojourner Truth. So that you can think about, as you think about Robert E. Lee up there on that pedestal, you can think about the ideologies of racial hatred that have ended in so much death and violence against Black people, but also the folks who have fought against that. So those are a couple of recontextualizations. And then we will support some people's efforts to relocate existing monuments or memorials. We don't, you know, cast our eyes upon the land and say, this goes down with you. Rather, we work with grantees, as with everything else we do, who come to us with projects and plans and visions and ideas for how they will want to teach our history in our public spaces.
Mm. You know, the Robert E. Lee Memorial, as it stands today in Richmond, is in its own way a pretty powerful monument. I don't know if you've seen it recently or an image of it recently, but it's covered in graffiti and surrounded by pictures of Black people killed by the police. Do you think that could ever be the monument? It tells a powerful story in a way at this moment.
I'm so happy you brought that up because I am really interested in not only, I mean, I said, you know, not just single statues alone, but also ephemeral monuments, monuments that are in unofficial ways put up by communities. I think an interesting question with that will be, is this something that we think the community will do for years? Is this something that will need special tending? Is this something that will become a site of contestation? Unto itself, I think it is a wonderful thing. And when I get into the nitty-gritty of, is that something we would support? Well, it might be taking care of itself, but it certainly is something that I would talk about when we think about the ways that we memorialize.
And an example that I'll mention that you've cited of a more inclusive, more successful monument is Maya Lin's celebrated Vietnam Memorial. And I see that another of your favorites is a 1994 installation in New Haven. You mentioned New Haven, called Path of Stars by Sheila de Bretville. Want to describe anything more about either of those?
Yeah, I'd love to. The thing that I think is so important about Maya Lin's memorial is that when you think about it in the context of all of the outsized figures on the mall and in that very commemorative landscape that is Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up in the midst of that, to build a monument without a figure and to build a monument that rather than go up, rather goes down into the ground, that it makes a slash in the earth, and that in order to experience it, you have to walk down into the earth, into that black slab, which I think allows us not to think of war as glorious, but rather to understand war as a site of tremendous human loss, tremendous sorrow. And then with those, I think it's now up to almost 60,000, 58 some thousand names that are on the wall. What I think is very interesting too is you have individual people who come and put their finger on the wall and find their dead and have their individual experience with someone they may have loved. But then you also have the kind of mass effect of others coming into the space and understanding what that war was all about. So I think that it was really important as far as the national understanding of what a memorial could be, and that it wasn't always a man on a horse, and that war itself, you know, our built memorial landscape says that acts of war and violence are something that we celebrate over and over and over and over again. And I feel like that monument really interrupted that narrative. In New Haven, the wonderful, they're like Hollywood stars in the streets of the Ninth Ward. This is made by the designer Sheila de Bretville. And they commemorate people who were dressmakers, people who were other kinds of workers and laborers in the history of New Haven in that neighborhood, which no longer has the same kind of activity that it once did. So it has the terrific effect of allowing you to, you know, a phrase I use a lot is I want to let the ground speak, right? You know, it tells you this is where you're walking. This is what happened here. This is who made this place. And these are people who would otherwise be forgotten, but for their families. But we're saying that they, and there are a lot of women in those stars, and we're saying remember them too. It's really wonderful. I like the things that you just live with every day. And if you imagine being a child walking with a grown up and saying, "What's that? What's that? What's that? Where are we? Who's that?" I think of this monuments project as being for the curious 6 and 7 and 8 year old walking with grown ups and wanting to know what happened.
Just last night, protesters in Portland overturned statues of Theodore Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln in a declaration of rage toward Columbus Day. Protesters spray-painted Dakota 38 on the base of Lincoln's statue, referencing the 38 Dakota men Lincoln approved to have hanged after the men were involved in a violent conflict with white settlers in Minnesota. Does that kind of thing undermine the politics or public perception of the whole project that you're involved with and are just describing, when even Lincoln gets targeted? Certainly the president and others are using that. Or is that part of the necessary conversation?
I think it can all be part of the conversation. I mean, I think it's just really important that we, you know, people must be responsible for their deeds. We must know their deeds. We must know them in their complexity. And then we can think about, you know, again, you know, where, how many. In Washington, D.C., in Lincoln Park, there's been some really interesting controversy because there's a statue of him where he is freeing the slaves, if you will, with one representative kneeling, and I think semi-clothed black man at his feet. And some people are saying, that the black man is, it's not a dignified position, you know, that statue should be taken away. But what I think is interesting about that space is that right across the park, a statue of the black educator, Mary McLeod Bethune, with children, black children, who she's teaching, you know, ostensibly the legacy of the end of slavery, looks right across in the eye to Abraham Lincoln. And that when the Lincoln statue was put up, Frederick Douglass gave a speech in that spot where he had a very critical and complex assessment of Abraham Lincoln. So I think, a final interesting part would be maybe even just a plaque that could help teach that part of things. Mm-hmm. I just think that, like, this is not, our history is not simplistic. The people who we raise up are sometimes complicated, but let's start off by giving us a much wider range of people to think about. You know, Harriet Tubman is someone who all Americans, all people should be able to identify with what it means to believe in freedom and what it means to risk your life over and over and over again to lead other people to freedom. So that's just one example of a figure who doesn't belong, you know, just to me or to you know, another black woman, but belongs to everybody.
Elizabeth Alexander, president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much. Always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.